Welcome to 101.5 Community Conversations on Wildfire, where we help you stay safe, informed, and ready. I'm your host, J.D. Haas. Today we're talking about something that affects all of us in Truckee and the region, the missing snowpack, and navigating the 2026 fire season. We're looking at this year's weather outlook and what that means for wildfire risk. Every fire season is shaped long before the first spark, by snowpack, by spring temperatures, by wind, and by how quickly our forests dry out. So what kind of season are we heading into? To help us understand that, we're joined by Dawn Johnson with the National Weather Service. Dawn, thank you so much for being here.
First, thank you so much for having me. My name is Dawn. I am the Warning Coordination Meteorologist out of the National Weather Service in Reno. I've been in the area since 2009 and love getting to pass along safety information and make sure that we can help our public out.
Well, we are going to have a lot of questions because I've been around a while, not as long as some others, but this is a very different season. There's really no data to go back to on this kind of season. Yes. Would I be correct in saying that?
Absolutely. Okay. So this season has stood out to us because not that we haven't had drought years before, not that we haven't had wet years before. What is interesting this year is that we have had near normal amounts of precipitation, so rain and snowmelt, but when it comes to how much snow we've had, we're in a warm snow drought. It has been a very warm winter overall. Then, of course, we can all remember what happened in March. Extreme record-breaking heat wave.
That's never happened, has it?
No. Oh my goodness. So March, we not only set the record for the warmest March, we set, I believe it was 9 daily records, broke the all-time warmest single day in March record. And believe it or not, if we put it into context, March would have almost surpassed what would have been the warmest April as well. We were only 2/10 of a degree shy of what the warmest April on record for Reno was as well.
That is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was so warm. It was like the shortest mountain bike season we ever had in Tahoe. It was happening and then all of a sudden it just came to an abrupt halt.
Yes.
So when you look at 2026 so far, how is this fire season shaping up compared to what we've seen in recent years?
Yeah, so this year is very different. You know, we don't have any analog years again that we've had near normal precipitation amounts, but such low snow, and then had the snow melt off this early in the season. So what is interesting this year is that we are looking at both large fuels being at play and the finer fuels, the grasses being at play as well. Now, the reason for this, normally when we have our wet years, we see a lot of grass growth, right? But we also see a lot of snow. And so our large fuels stay quite wet and our grass crop, it grows, it dries out, but that's more of those quick moving, flashier type fires, whereas the large fuels are those big forest fires that we deal with. So this year we've had the precipitation, right? So we have another grass crop that is starting to already grow. And because we greened up so early in the season, I mean, stuff was blooming in like mid-March. We now have a longer period of time for that crop to dry out. Plus, we've had multiple years now where we have been wet. So we've had multiple years of grass crops that have grown and they have subsequently dried, become now kindling for fires, essentially. We did not have a lot of low elevation snow, so that didn't pack down the grasses, which actually allows it to burn easier. Now let's flip the tables. Let's talk about our larger fuels, our forest fire fuels, right? We call them 1,000-hour fuels. So when we are looking at those, we typically we'll see dry years being the problem, right? Because when it's in a drought, those trees become drought stressed. We've seen a lot of, you know, we went through like the mid, what was it 2014 to about 2016. We had a lot of drought. We had a lot of trees die off. We had bark beetle infestations. And so those fuels became available. Now this year, because we've had so little snow, those trees are actually going to be able to dry out for a longer period and become drought stressed again, which now puts the large fuels into play. So I personally have never seen a setup like this, and I was working with one of our fire partners. He is a division chief, 25 years of doing this. He also says he has never seen a setup where both the large and the fine fuels are at play.
You called it 1,000-hour fuels?
Mm-hmm.
What's the terminology behind that?
We look at fuels, basically we break them down into finer fuels. They're kind of like your 1 and 10 hour fuels. We have 100 hour fuels. We have 1,000 hour fuels. And what it's kind of looking at is like the amount of time it takes for a fuel to dry out. So the ones that are the finer fuels, the 1 hour, the 10 hour, those sort of things, they see large fluctuations back and forth between wet and dry, depending on how high humidity is, depending on if we've had recent rains. The large fuels take a lot more time for them to either become basically more inundated with moisture from rain or snow, and it takes a lot longer for them to dry out as well. So it's really just kind of measuring the time frames on which these fuels were moisten up or dry out.
Sounds like we're kicking the can down the road, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Because I was going to break out a calculator. I was going to go 1,000 divided by 24 and scary. So early season snowmelt, you know, it does feel especially important. Now, for folks listening, how does snowpack or lack of it translate into fire risk later in the season?
So the earlier we lose the snowpack, it typically means the longer the dry season. We typically only see 17% of our annual precipitation from April through September. And when we see our snow years, we typically are going to be seeing that snow linger, you know, April, May, June. It takes time for it to melt off. That provides a nice steady stream of moisture into our forests. If we see it melt off early, and this year was, again, record-breaking with how early it melted off. We are talking 4 to 8 weeks ahead of schedule compared to what's normal.
Yes.
Then it just gives us a much longer time frame for those trees to be drying out and become drought stressed. We're getting into our dry season, right? So unless we see what we've been seeing, you know, we got kind of lucky here that April was, you know, fairly wet. Right now we have things that are staying that way as well. But as we head into the next few weeks, it's looking warm and dry.
We are looking for Mother Nature to bring us a little bit of relief. Okay, climate patterns. Are there any of them, like persistent drought or warming trends, playing into this year's outlook?
So what is really interesting with climate is whenever we go through anything unusual, we get asked the question, is this climate change?
Okay.
And a single year or a single event can never determine this. We're looking usually over at least 30-year periods. So that being said, though, if you look at kind of the last 10 to 15 years around here, we have not been seeing winters fit, you know, I'm going to do quotes here, climatic norms, right? We have been seeing significant periods of drought where we go 3-4+ years of drought conditions. We've also seen two of our all-time wettest winters being 2016, 2017, and 2022, 2023. And so we are really seeing much larger swings, the drought deluge type of cycles. And we're also seeing differences in timing. When is that precipitation actually falling? We've been seeing kind of a trend where we're starting to get into it a little bit later in the season, but then we're also seeing it extend further into the spring. So we are seeing some changes taking place, but I can't attribute this year in particular to that.
You started throwing years out there. 2021, Dixie Caldor fire. Mm-hmm. I remember standing while driving on Brockway in 267, and I had a plume to the south and I had a plume to the north. And to see those plumes, they are massive. They are going thousands of feet into the atmosphere. So looking at the 2026 data, which previous year in your records does this most closely resemble? And are we looking at a repeat of 2021, or is this completely different animal because of the specific timing of the March heat wave?
So they are very different animals.
They are? Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you. Gosh, I hope it's better than what we had for Dixie Caldor.
Yes, trust me. That summer stands out without a doubt. That was a really bad year. And if we want to talk about 2020, 2021, the winter that led into that summer, it was bad. We only saw 40 to 50% of our precipitation total for the year. And that was coming off of a drought in 20 as well. So we're now talking 2 years of significant precipitation deficits. Okay. We're talking, again, 40 to 50% of normal both years. So it was really dry, a lot of drought stress, and it just took off. So this year, I cannot say is similar to 2020, 2021. And in all honesty, there really is not an analog year for it because we have not seen this early of a melt-off ever, nor have we seen such a difference between the liquid totals and the snow totals that we're dealing with for the year.
Talk about those. Talk about liquid totals and snow totals.
Yes. We have actually, so we look at our water year. Water year goes from October 1st through September 30th. That's just our typical how we measure things. And the reason for that is because when do we get most of our water? From October through usually March. When we look at the amount of liquid that has fallen from the sky, we're actually sitting near to slightly above normal. But our snowfall overall, I mean, I'm talking, let's go back to February, right?
Okay.
We saw a nice storm in February, followed by a warm system that actually melted off a lot of snow. At that point, we were sitting roughly 60-ish percent of normal, a little higher as you went south into what's known as the Walker Basin. But for the Truckee Basin, we were about 60% of normal. We wiped that away very quickly because we had the warm system, and then we had our March heat wave. That part of it is highly unusual. Why do we look at them separately? We want to look at the amount of snow we have and how much water is in the snow, because it in turn informs how much runoff we're going to have, our soil moisture, our water supply outlooks. All of that is huge for so many industries, whether it be recreation, whether it be agriculture. People are depending on the water, and they're depending on the water coming at the typical time. You know, our typical melt-off peak runoff period is going to be usually anywhere from April through June. That's when we're looking at things. And we peaked out in late February into March this year.
Wow, we really did. It was, I'm thinking back, it's been so wild because that 5 feet of snow came and it disappeared. It disappeared as fast as it came.
Yep.
There was 5 feet of snow on the ground, and then all of a sudden it was gone like a magic trick.
And the, you know, if you want to talk about the meteorological magic behind that.
Yeah, I do. Tell me.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
A warm, wet system that came in behind it. So not only did the temperatures climb, we also had high humidity and we had wind. So the snow became ripe. Snow, when it first falls, it actually can absorb a lot more water. It will melt off right away. It needs to get to the point of what we consider ripe, meaning that it will begin to melt. So if you think about like an ice cube, right? If you first apply heat to it, it doesn't start to melt really quick, right? It's slow. But as that is constantly applied, it suddenly starts melting, and you'll notice how much faster it begins to accelerate its melt process. So when it comes to snow, when you get rain on top of it, it absorbs it up to a certain point, and then it gets to the point it can't absorb anything else. And that's when you start passing the rain through it and melting off the snow. When you have wind, it actually acts to eat away at the snow as well. When you have warm temperatures, that also is going to melt it. So it was like a triple whammy hitting the snowpack. We even saw examples where we didn't get a drop of rain, and just between the wind and the warmth, 2 feet of snow disappeared in a matter of 24 to 48 hours.
Disappeared. And I was hoping for cold temperatures, because usually when the cold temperatures come behind it and the snow absorbs the rain, this is the long-term storage of that. And then it didn't happen.
Nope.
It completely disappeared. It was ripe. That's my new word, ripe.
Yes.
I like that. I always say on the radio that Mother Nature, she has given and now she is taking it away. So she can re-gift it another day. But boy, she took it really fast.
And yeah, she gifted it again in April.
Yes.
But if we have snow falling on bare ground, especially this late in the year, it doesn't last. If we got us, you know, what we had in April falling on top of a good snowpack, it actually would have stuck around better. Yeah. A little more insulating properties there.
I know, huh? It's not just about how much snow we get. It's about how it behaves afterwards. So when you're thinking about dangerous fire conditions, what are the key weather ingredients you're watching most closely?
We generally are looking at what the overall antecedent conditions are, meaning what has happened. So we're looking at how much snow has fallen. When did that snow melt? What is our overall liquid totals? What have they been for the year? What is our soil moisture looking like? Have we had any abnormal heat waves? Any unusual long dry stretches? So that is kind of, we're looking back. And then when we're looking ahead, we start looking at the forecast. Are we going to be seeing any drier, windy periods upcoming? Do we have any lightning that we have to worry about? And specifically, dry lightning.
Dry lightning and wind. That's a factor too.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen dry lightning hit. No wind for 3 to 5 days. It's burning underground.
Mm-hmm.
Wind happens. Fire comes above the soil, fire specifically Olympic Valley on the ridge as you're making your way in. They had dry lightning the week before. And a week later, all of a sudden, people are going, why is there a fire on the ridge? Mm-hmm. As we looked out across Olympic Valley, and there was a DC-10 500 feet off the ground coming right over.
Yep.
We're so fortunate. So talk about that. Let's talk about wind and lightning and where that all fits into the picture.
Yeah. So what you were just describing, we call a sleeper or a holdover fire. And we, you know, sleeper kind of refers to the fact that it might just be smoldering, tree stump, something underground. And it takes a wind event or it takes a heat wave. It takes something to wake it up again. And once that gets going, you can have a full blown wildfire on your hand as soon as it turns hot, dry and windy. So let's go into the wind. Wind is actually the greatest weather determinant on wildfire. It, and especially if you combine it with a heat wave, can further dry fuels. And if there is an active fire, wind is almost like a giant bellow. It's pumping fresh oxygen into the fire and helps to increase the rate of combustion from it. It can physically tilt the flame front forward. So it's preheating the unburned fuels ahead of the fire. And then strong winds can also carry embers a long way. So we can see spot fires miles in advance of the main fire line. The other thing to think about is how complex the terrain is in the Sierra. So the shape of the land can actually create its own wind and override the larger weather pattern. Canyons can accelerate winds as the air funnels through them. Think about putting your thumb over your hose, right?
Yep.
It's the same exact thing. It just squeezes it and makes it go faster.
Mm.
Slope also plays a role. So for every 10 degree increase in slope, it can actually double the rate of speed of a fire, even in absence of wind.
Oh my goodness. There's the technical stuff.
Let's say, you know, I'm holding my hand up right now like it's a slope. So if we increase the angle of our slope by 10 degrees, that can double the rate of spread on a flaming front of a wildfire, even if you don't have any additional wind.
Okay. And so basically for your minds, listeners, and for those who've ever been out the Palisades, just think about exhibition and how exhibition works its way up the E-space. That gets steeper and steeper and steeper, and that will then double that rate of speed on that. Let's apply that to this region here. And what makes us unique when it does come to this fire weather?
Yeah, the Sierra is very unique because of its topography. So we were just talking about how the various canyons and different terrain can help to funnel the wind. We also have a rain shadow. Anyone who has crossed over Donner Pass knows once you get under the western slopes, it tends to be a lot greener over there, right?
Yes.
They get a lot more rainfall. If you look at the numbers, Sierra Crest, for example, roughly 4 to 450 inches of snow a year on average. You get to Truckee, we're now down to 200 inches of snow a year on average. You go out to Reno, 24 inches of snow a year on average. So there's this huge drying effect as we get into what we call the lee. That's the downwind side of the mountains of the Sierra. So we have that. We have mountain-driven wind patterns. We actually have typical, what we would call diurnal. So it changes day to night. Wind patterns, depending all on mountain meteorology and the differences of heating and cooling that are taking place, which causes the motion of air. We can see thermal belts within canyons and valleys. So that actually causes warmer and drier layers within a valley. So we might see cooler and wetter conditions at the valley floor. And then as you climb, we have where a thermal belt is. It's kind of an inversion layer, warmer and drier that area. So those areas cure faster and can cause more active wildfire activity as well. And then it, again, decreases as you keep going up. We also see some very interesting weather extremes. We already have talked about this, where we seem to be going much more drought deluge. It's so rare now to have a, quote, typical year. And so that is another thing that's really unique here. Then if we have a thunderstorm, a single thunderstorm moving along the crest can ignite dozens of wildfires in very remote, hard-to-access terrain. Sleeper fires can result. And then once they're finally large enough to be detected, it's usually too late and hard to access them.
That kind of answers my next question. How does elevation and forest conditions influence the fire risk here? It's the same, I think, right?
Generally, yes. So elevation, you're going to be seeing different types of fuels. We are going to be seeing, you know, the grasses at the lower elevations transitioning to more of the forest. And even the types of pines vary as you go through the forest. Anyone who's hiked around here has seen that. We will actually see the mid elevations are actually usually the worst. And that's because that's the transition point. And we also see the highest amount of fuel loading there. So we have ladder fuels that can take the ground wildfire up into the crown of the treetops, which makes it really dangerous because it's exposed to higher winds and it can make big runs. And as we were talking about, recent droughts have contributed to millions of trees dying in the Sierra.
Yes.
And the bark beetle attacks, there's standing dead fuels that can burn with incredible intensity.
And you can really see those when you're leaving Truckee on I-80 and traveling east and you look up Mount Rose, you can see it. Just look across the skyline of the mountain and you can see all those dead trees up there.
And we saw when we had the Davis fire.
Crazy.
Took things out really quickly in that area.
Super fast, wind driven.
Mm-hmm.
Right down 395.
Yes.
Yeah, it didn't burn the chocolate nugget man though.
They went and saved that one.
They saved. Yes. My friends were all calling me going, why isn't there more information on this? The information that they were giving the people was fast and accurate and exactly what to do. But everybody wants to know, right? We all want this information right now and we want to know. So if you're listening to this, I'll give you one tip. If you really want to know, watch duty. These folks have a great app. If you want to know to the second, you can go right there and get that information. And those folks that are out there fighting the fire and bringing that and taking it head on, they're on 12-hour shift changes. So that information actually does not move for every 12 hours. And you're not going to get the information you want. So if you want it to the second, you want to know when the helicopters are coming, you want to know how many planes in the air, how many battalions are on the ground, you go to watch duty, sign up for that, and that'll give you like almost moment to moment play by play with the fire. So
yes, I highly recommend it. We use it in the office as well.
It's and that's those are all people who have multiple decades of experience, from fire chiefs to weather people. They are the ones that are actually operating this app and carrying hundreds of years of experience. So I don't want to get too lost on that because, but I just thought it was a great place. I don't want to cause fear, whatever, with this, but are there particular areas in our region that tend to be more vulnerable?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So right now, the places where we most are concerned with are what's known as the WUI. It's the Wildland Urban Interface. So if you ever hear the term WUI, W-U-I, Wildland Urban Interface. Why is this a concern? Well, we're seeing as the region expands, more and more people are building up against the forest locations, right? Beautiful area to live, but very dangerous. High population density, flashy fuels, and anyone in these areas needs to be aware and make sure that they have defensible space around their home. So we also are looking at if you're at a base of a canyon or a steep valley, because those winds can accelerate down that canyon, you're also at a higher risk because things can accelerate right through there. We are constantly, our agency, we're working with emergency managers and fire officials. We're actually looking at these. We're looking at worst case scenarios. We're looking at specifically if a fire starts in like your worst possible area, what does that look like? And what's the worst the winds can get? And where do we need to evacuate? And that is so that ultimately you can save their lives. We also know our fire partners are very proactively managing prescribed burns to the best of their abilities because they want to limit how much fuels are around, especially in these wildland urban interface areas.
Sounds like all of Truckee.
Truckee is a hotspot without a doubt.
I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, yes. Unless you're in downtown or you're sitting in the middle of the school with, 200 yards of concrete around you, it's sounds like the whole entire place that we've built.
Yes, and a lot of the Tahoe Basin is like this. We see more and more population moving here, whether it be permanent or vacation homes. You know, after we went through COVID, a lot of people moved to their vacation home up in Tahoe because they can now work remotely. And so you have more full-time residents. You have people who are enjoying the beauty that's surrounding them. And if you've only been here for a couple of years, you haven't seen a bad fire season because the last few years have been fine. You're not thinking back to 2020 or 2021, right?
Yeah. Really good point to make, Dawn. Mm-hmm. They haven't seen it. So they're sitting here probably going, wait until, and it's going to happen somewhere. Let's just hope it's not within our wooey, right?
Yes. I mean, we saw what happened with Kaldor.
And the way they walked the fire around the town, I was the lead broadcaster on that fire from this side because everybody evacuated. Even the radio station left South Lake Tahoe and packed up. And I sat on this side and we brought the town halls and I watched these firefighters move this fire around neighborhoods the way that they did. And it was so important that everybody left.
Yes, absolutely.
As much as I don't want to leave, but what I saw at that Kaldor fire and learned from that, and it ended up going up into a big pile of rocks. And that's where they had the chance to beat it. Kind of like and that goes back to my first fire, the Angora fire. It burnt through all those homes. And you can go for a ride on your bike through there. There's some great mountain bike trails with some horrible history. But you can look at that fire and how it burnt straight up that canyon. And once it got to the rocks, it stopped. That was it. So
I was going to say, Kaldor and Dixie were unusual because, you know, Angora, you say it gets to the rocks, it stopped. Kaldor and Dixie, it was the first time in history we have seen wildfires jump the crest, right? The crest, it's a solid granite piece. But because these things were burning so intensely, we were seeing spot fires well ahead of the main line, which then caused new ignitions on the other side.
And that way... So now you take me back to the King Fire. Let's talk about the King Fire for a minute, okay? Wayne Huntsman, you know, if you don't know how it started, go figure that out yourself. I was on that one. But the ashes that were coming up over Donner's Summit, and I'll never forget, every fire agency was positioned on these granite peaks, and they were doing everything they could to hold this back, and there was quarter-size embers coming over.
Yep, flaming embers, right?
And they were landing on I-80, and it was surreal how big that was and how far ahead of the fire that this fire was actually creating its own climate and moving those embers into Truckee from there.
Yes.
It was a scary time. And I'm thinking about it. I want to leave one tip for my listeners on that fire, because since I was the broadcaster on there, I have a home in Truckee.
Yes.
And so what I did is we're all working on our defensible space, but I personally took every 5-gallon bucket of water I had before I left to go do the stories. I filled them all up and I circled them like wagons around my house. So if the fire came to my neighborhood in the Armstrong track, that the fire department saw it was there and they could easily throw a 5-gallon bucket of water on that ember. So that's a little tip. If you have to evacuate, fill every single bucket and circle the house.
Absolutely.
So there you go. Go ahead. This is about you. It's been a long fire season. It really has. Yes. It's been a lifelong fire season, and it really didn't kick off until the early 2000s.
It used to be where we could say, hey, it's fire season, it's not fire season. And reality is there's no off season anymore. We kind of recognize there's a higher season and a lower season, but we know that wildfires can strike year round, and it just depends on those conditions that we spoke about earlier. And so these high and low seasons are kind of determined by the antecedent conditions and the fire risk, but it's year round that we have a risk now.
Year round, because there's no it's fire season starting earlier, longer, or both. No, it's year round. We had our first official wildfire at Donner Lake in March.
Yep, in March. Come on.
I know our minds were elsewhere, but the first official fire of the season was in March of this year at Donner Lake, and it was running uphill. I kind of already know where we're going to go. When should residents be most on alert this year?
Now. So when we were first getting fuels reports back at the end of March, we honestly thought we were game over. We were like, this is going to be horrific. April, it kind of, I'm not going to say it saved us. I'm going to say it's kicking the can down the road. It's helping. It's better than, you know, if we had another March in April, oh my goodness, would this have been a bad season? The fact that we've gotten some stuff, it has been helpful. But our fuels intel is showing us that we are well ahead of schedule. with where we should be for fuels, right? So example being in March, late March, I was getting fuels intel that things were similar to what you'd see in late May, early June. Again, because we've had a wet April, fuels are moistened up a little bit. So we're more like a month or so ahead of schedule as opposed to 2 or 3 months ahead of schedule now. But all it's going to take is a couple of warm and dry weeks, which again, following this is what we're getting into. Those fuels are going to be curing and ready to go. All the official fire outlooks from the National Interagency Fire Center, they do basically wildland fire prediction. It's saying basically buckle up come June.
Buckling up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Kevin Meekum kind of said from the U.S. Forest Service to me in the same context was, and I give it to you in layman's terms, there's not enough t-shirts available to make Truckee strong. So what do we need to do? We need to be Truckee strong now.
Absolutely.
And that's so important to this whole situation because we all play a part in it.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about our parts in it in a minute.
Yes.
Shoulder season, spring and fall become more of a concern.
Yes. When we get into the shoulder seasons, I think part of the problem is that people just let their guard down. You know, when it's midsummer, it's in your face, you're seeing forest closures because of the fire risk, you're seeing camping restrictions because of the fire risk, you know about it. It's front and center. When it is spring, when it is fall, your mindset's not there. Fall generally is going to be a lot worse than spring. And the reason for that is we're following that hot, dry period coming out of summer, and we have been getting later into the fall to see our first big, you know, precipitation event, which kind of helps to put a little lid on things. Also, in fall, we tend to get a lot of big wind events.
Yes, we do.
So I would say shoulder seasons for sure, but fall especially. And we have seen so many wildfires crop up in October, November, December. And you think back to the LA wildfires, January, right?
Man.
Again, no off season.
And when you say wind in late season, that brings me to red flag warnings. Ed, you guys have recently updated how red flag warnings are communicated to be more impact-based. So can you walk us through the red flag versus fire weather watch distinction?
Yes. So a fire weather watch means that we have at least 50% confidence that the ingredients are coming together for dangerous fire conditions. Think of it as your get set. When it's a warning, this is now go. Go time. That means conditions are occurring or imminent. We have at least 80% confidence that these conditions are coming together. A way I like to think about it is in terms of food, because who doesn't like food? So one way you can think about it, let's say you're a sweets fan, cupcakes. With a watch, you have all the ingredients in your pantry to make the cupcakes, but you haven't made them yet. With a warning, cupcakes are made. Time to eat them. Or let's say you prefer more savory, let's go tacos. Your taco watch means you have your taco bar with all of the ingredients you like to put into your taco, but it's not together yet. When it's a warning, your taco is now constructed and it's time to eat.
I'm hungry. I like vanilla.
You want a vanilla cupcake?
Yeah, I like vanilla cupcakes. that's our, okay, are we seeing more extreme categories being developed as our seasons get more intense?
Yes, so roughly 6-7 years ago, our office helped lead the way in developing what's known as a particularly dangerous situation, or PDS, red flag warning. So that's like the worst of the worst. Okay. So they're very rare, very high confidence. So 95% plus confidence levels, very rare combinations where we're looking at extreme winds, very low humidity and dry fuels. We may only issue them once per year or every other year. So kind of think about these situations like the campfire in Paradise, where at the absolute peak rate of spread, that fire was moving at upwards of 80 football fields a minute. Okay, these are...
Please repeat that.
80 football fields every minute at its peak rate of spread. You're not outrunning that. You're not outdriving that. Right?
No.
This is why we have this category. We've only issued 6 of these in our history. We save this for the worst of the worst. So if you see us put out what's known as a PDS red flag, pay attention.
80 football fields per how long?
Minute.
Crazy.
I mean, that again.
Do you know the dates, those 6? Do you know the times those six times in history a PDS was?
I would have to look them up.
I know.
Off the top of my head, I don't remember them. I'm sorry. I can tell you the last one was for the Davis Fire.
Yes, it was.
Yes. And we did that because it was located in, you know, we're talking about the WUI. It was in that WUI. And we were looking at winds of 40 to 50 miles per hour in steep terrain with a lot of humans living adjacent to it.
That was crazy. And if I remember correctly, am I correct in saying that was human caused out of the camp area, out of that?
Yes.
It was.
From what I remember, it was from a campfire.
Man, a lot of people ask me, well, these are campgrounds. Why are they still allowed to have campfires during these times? Someone asked me that the other day. I'm going to have to get somebody in here to talk to me about that. Before we go into fire fatigue, that Davis fire, you took me back well into the late 70s to that other fire that burned above Davis Mansion. You can see the scar across the valley. And that was like the first fire of magnitude I ever saw. That was a thing. These were new. And we got in the car and it was, you know, Davis was way out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in the car and it was 55 miles an hour and there was no bypass. And we drove out there and we watched that thing burn every night after dinner.
Wow.
It was, you're taking me back to places. So I've been living with fire a long time. The more you talk, the more
memories are coming back.
Yeah. Yes. And I did not know now thinking about that fire because it burnt all the way from the south end. And if you look at the scar, it came all the way across the valley towards Bower's Mansion, mm-hmm. where that's at. So you can see those. I'll talk with listeners about fire scars another day. Let's talk about fire fatigue. It feels like a real thing in Truckee. So when people see constant alerts, you start to tune them out. You know, how do you as a meteorologist phrase your warnings to ensure they still carry weight and urgency without causing residents just to shut down?
So 100% agree with you. It's not just fire warnings. It can apply to any warning. You know, we have to balance the keeping people prepared with overwarning so that they stop listening. So we want to speak to people in plain language. You know, we're all humans at our office. We're a 24/7, 365 facility focused on keeping people safe, right? We don't want you to view us as this black box computer. We want you to view us as humans. And that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to be out in the community, working with our emergency managers, working with our officials to make sure we can keep those people safe. So we want to talk to them in their language and explain the impact, not the weather, but the impact that weather is going to have on you. Learn what are your decision thresholds and then be able to gear the forecast towards how it will impact you directly. So let's say that local residents have a significant fire threat. We might use wording like, fires will spread faster than you can run. This is a life safety event. Pay close attention, have a way to get alerts, and make sure there's a go bag at your front door. Or, a fire today will move faster than emergency crews can warn you. If you see smoke, don't wait for a text alert. Leave now. We also want to be very specific with landmarks. We have found that referencing maps, a lot of people have problems with it. But if you reference very localized landmarks within the town, within the community, then it's like, oh, I know that cafe, or, oh, I know that historical landmark, and it becomes much more personal to you.
Oh, you know the Golden Nugget chocolate guy.
Yes.
Okay.
See, we already said that. And then we also have call to action statements. We want to save the most extreme wording with the warnings for the events that warned it. We don't want to just throw around these terms unless they have meaning to back them up. So we kind of say that our goal is informed anxiety. We want people to be nervous enough to take action, but informed enough that they have the tools to survive.
And you know what I keep thinking the whole time you're talking to me about this is a lot of folks don't know it's a minimum of 10 years before the WUI interface of Truckee is even at an acceptable level. 10 years of all this work, we're going to see so much more work over the next 10 years. It's a tragedy and a modern day gold rush. Two things on both sides.
Definitely.
What are the biggest mistakes people make when interpreting weather forecasts related to fire?
Not thinking it'll happen to you, number one. And I can't even begin to tell you how many times we put out these very strongly worded alerts. And I get the, Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it.
And not thinking that it's going to happen, not thinking that it's going to happen to you directly. And then also keep in mind, even if it's dry and windy, you need a spark. You need something to ignite that fire. Roughly 80% of fires are human caused, and the majority of these are accidental. So don't think that lightning is the only concern. You personally, if you hear that there is a red flag warning, are you annoyed that it's windy again? Or do you start thinking about how dry your landscape is? What comes to mind? 60 to 90% of home loss in a wildfire are from embers ahead of that main flame front, and that falls onto combustible materials. So the best thing you can do, as we've already talked about, have defensible space around your home, practice other home hardening techniques, and if you ever visit Living with Fire, they have amazing resources to point out areas that you can improve upon so that your home is more fire resistant.
Now, is that the most reliable and up-to-date information there? Or is there other places?
I would 100% recommend Living with Fire. It is a great extension program. We work with them closely, and they have amazing resources for both defensible space information as well as home hardening techniques.
So if there's one thing you want people in our community to understand about this upcoming fire season, what is it?
We kind of skipped spring, for lack of a better term, right? And I'm not going to say we, you know, again, spring around here, we have our ups, we have our downs. That is very typical. But in relation to snow melt and runoff, it has been just skipped, right? We had a warm winter. We melted off that snow 4 to 8 weeks ahead of schedule. The Eastern Sierra as a whole is sitting in the lowest 10th percentile. When you look at the 31 SnowTel or snow telemetry sites, these are our remote sensors that we have up in the mountains that measure snowfall, liquid equivalent, and a whole number of things for us. Our April storms have been very beneficial, but it's only kind of delaying the inevitable. And we already talked about, you know, our fuels are sitting at not exactly levels we want to see right now. They're a lot drier. And as we get further into summer, they're going to just keep drying out. Your eyes are going to deceive you. It might look green out there right now. You might see water flowing right now. But the early green up means that the fuels are also going to cure sooner. Our typical spring peaks on our creeks, rivers, and streams, usually going to be May, June, and maybe even into July in big years. We saw it late February and March. So there's not going to be that water left when we typically see it.
I'm building a brick house.
Probably a good idea.
And I'm going to surround it with rocks. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's my concern. So what gives you concern? What gives you hope? And when you look at this year's outlook,
my concern is we just have never seen anything set up like this before. And then we also know that as we get into summer, typical summer precipitation comes with thunderstorms, which means lightning. But we do know that 85 to even sometimes upwards of 90% of fires are human caused. So you can play a role. Truckee can be strong together. You can make sure that you're properly stowing your chains. Don't park over dry grass. You can make sure your brakes are operating properly, so when you're going downhill, you're not causing sparks. If you're doing yard work, use those lawnmowers, chainsaws, and weed whackers outside of the hottest and driest parts of the day. Make sure you drown your campfires. Avoid target shooting in dry areas. And this should be obvious, but don't ever toss a cigarette butt out the window. The other thing that's given me hope as well is I know that this county is really preparing for things. I work with emergency management from the town of Truckee. I know people with the county itself, and you can actually sign up with your county to get alert notifications and evacuation notifications. So they actually have a new system. If you want to visit their website for Nevada County Alerts, it is nevadacountyca.gov/3780/emergency-alerts. Or if you don't want to remember all that, just dial 211. Just make sure as we get into the season that you are verifying all information you're hearing as well, because we know during a rapidly unfolding event, there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there.
There is. And for our listeners outside the Nevada County area, Tahoe Alerts as well, that you can sign up there to get your notifications. But again, 211 is where you go to get more information to direct you. Well, Dawn, knowledge is power. And you've given us a lot of it today. If you're just tuning in, this is Don Johnson with the National Weather Service. Thank you so much for helping us better understand what's ahead and how we can prepare.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today. And everyone, stay fire safe out there.
I'm J.D. Haas, your 101.5 Community Conversations on Wildfire host. Stay safe, stay informed, and let's keep talking.
This message provided by Truckee Fire as part of the Measure T Community Wildfire Prevention Fund.